morning. It's Friday, May 1st, May Day, and welcome to the Zogby Report, real and unrehearsed. This is our weekly Friday where my son and business partner Jeremy and I review some of the major news of the week and share our thoughts from two different points of view, two different age cohorts. Good morning, Jer. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing well considering that May 1st is supposed to be warm and sunny, and here it looks November today. So we'll work with that.
Yeah, it is pretty ugly. But anyway, what are we talking about today? What do you have?
Well, last week you alluded to that you wanted to get into some solutions. And so I was thinking about some of the work that we're doing currently with, I probably can't disclose the name of the village, but it's a historic village in upstate New York, and it bears the name of a Revolutionary War general that still conceals the identity, because there are many of those in upstate New York. But we're doing a study on economic development, and I'm investigating through influencer interviews, you know, whether it's the former mayors, the former deputies, school board heads, superintendents, small business owners, lawyers, real estate agents, you get the picture. And I'm, you know, getting a real clear picture of what is going wrong and what could be done. What are the great resources of the village? How can they move forward amidst this crisis? And I thought that this study is the perfect backdrop to what you wanted to talk about when you mentioned last week, solutions. So whether it's at the local government level, the state level, what solutions do we have? And before we get into that, I'm gonna have our listeners hang on, on the cliff for that discussion. But actually, what we should talk about first and foremost is the piece on the Hill that came out yesterday about Hillary lurking in the background, and that scenario in which could Hillary be the VP pick? And then from that, situation, does Biden continue to tank because of the Terry Reid story, or does he get through it? And if he does tank, does Hillary become the nominee? So let's dissect that and some other potential scenarios of who the VP could be.
Okay. All right. So let's attack these piece by piece. The first is the notion of Hillary lurking in the shadows. I would agree that she thinks that she's lurking in the shadows, but I would also disagree by saying I don't think that there are five people alive, or certainly any affiliated with the Democratic National Committee, that would favor her as a running mate, or in fact as leading the ticket in case Biden falters. Very simply, there just is not a movement percolating from below, a draft Hillary movement. And then you'd also have to ask, what would she bring to the ticket? You know, arguably in her favor, experience, not only the nominee, but she won in 2016, but she won the popular vote. By the same token, Biden has to choose someone, A, who doesn't overshadow him. That's always a rule for vice presidential nominees. And secondly, someone who doesn't carry any baggage or would be the focus of more attention, negative attention. And, you know, that is not Hillary Clinton. And so I'm going to go beyond virtually and say absolutely no possibility that Hillary Clinton emerges on the ticket as either president or vice president.
The only thing that I could say on the contrary to that is it seems to be ever since 2015 that the face of 30 Rockefeller, the face of reality TV, appeared on the scene and ushered us into the presidential reality show and won the presidency. So I almost feel like since 2016 and especially into 2020, we are in bizarro world. So yeah. It wouldn't surprise me because we are living in a political bizarro world. But what about this next notion? So Biden came out a week ago and he said basically that I would welcome Michelle Obama onto my ticket. So what does Michelle Obama do realistically after pretty much getting, in so many words, an invitation?
What does she do? She does what she's continuing to do because it's working for her, and probably could very well work for Biden. And that is that she campaigns vigorously for Biden as the most popular woman, not only in the United States, but in the world today. Any move on her part to be on a ticket would go against everything that she is or stands for. I mean, she has stated publicly that she did not love the 8 years and the scrutiny in the White House. She's doesn't want it back. She's emerged in pristine condition. And, you know, to be on the ticket again have an Obama on the ticket would kind of neutralize the popularity, increase the scrutiny, certainly overshadow Joe Biden. And remember, no presidential nominee wants that. And so I know I'm being particularly strong when I use words like absolutely and unequivocally, but I think we're pretty close to that in saying that there won't be an Obama and there won't be a Clinton on the tickets for all the reasons that I've mentioned.
Yeah. And I guess I would just say, I mean, you would at least agree that in the hypothetical scenario that Michelle Obama was asked or accepted that and was put on the ticket as VP, that would pretty much, if there's anything close to bulletproofing a presidential campaign, and especially in 2020, would you agree that that would do it? That could be the single best thing that Biden could do to come close to ensuring defeating Trump?
She'd be enormously popular. She would be single-handedly the person responsible for increasing the turnout of African Americans, particularly African American women, younger women as well. And sure, obviously it would work. On a personal level, it would open her up to being treated like any other candidate. On a personal level, that just wouldn't fly for her. It'd be a step down.
Do you see a future where she runs for president?
I don't think so. I go back, there's one pretty good example, and that would be Colin Powell. And Colin Powell, there were personal reasons why he batted down speculation. You know, he was always considered the front runner, you know, the bulletproof potential nominee. But he was also one of the most popular men in the United States, and he opted for what I would call the great could have been. Meaning that's a better place to be in than having all the scrutiny of pro and con of after you've been president of the United States historically. She will always be the great could have been, which always leads to positive conclusions.
So you wrote a piece, an op-ed this week, and I would imagine that a lot of our listeners probably saw that. It was pretty well circulated, but you had seven candidates and you went in reverse order. And let's just let's reveal who the winner was, who you've mentioned before, the Michigan governor. So yeah. Any news? I mean, you've laid it out before in previous weeks, but is there anything new to add to why her case is stronger than ever today, May 1st, 2020?
Yeah, which would be about 6 or 7 days after I wrote the piece, and I encourage people to read it. It's on our website. Yeah, she is in the middle of one of the key controversies today, which is turning out in many ways to be a very partisan controversy. And that is, do we open up the economy, reopen segments of the economy earlier, or wait for more testing and more definitive results as to whether or not the curve is flattening, so to speak, on the virus itself. And so essentially, she has taken a very strong stance on the health side of things, saying we're just not ready to reopen the economy. And there have been protests. From my vantage point, plenty of evidence showing that despite huge frustration and worry among, you know, large segments of people who've been laid off from their work about wondering, you know, what's next, including putting food on the table, that these are well-organized conservative protests. And she has stood up to that and not only raised her profile, but raised her profile, I think, particularly among the kinds of constituencies that the Democrats need in order to win. She's also increased her popularity. This is Gretchen Whitmer, for those who are wondering, increased her popularity in Michigan, where she's given much higher marks for handling the whole coronavirus crisis, handling it much better than Donald Trump is handling it. So I still think that she's in the lead.
So from a strategic standpoint, picking a governor from a swing state that is obviously a battleground, but is increasingly becoming a battleground. Mm-hmm. From Biden's perspective, it's beyond just Michigan. It's regional. She's the Midwesterner. Is that what you're saying?
She's a Midwesterner. Yeah. First of all, Michigan has 16 electoral votes. That's substantial. And Mr. Trump won Michigan by, you know, about 10,000 votes. It was reliably a blue state since 1992. But yeah, she then has the real potential of bringing in Wisconsin as well, which surprised everyone that the Hillary lost in Wisconsin. And then there's always the possibility of the bigger kahuna, which is Ohio, where right now it's very competitive. It's almost even between Trump and Biden. So that would be a good regional choice. And that's behind my thinking.
Let's take a short break before we move on to our next segment. Let's move on to our second segment about solutions. The backdrop of this is the study that we're conducting for a municipal government in the Mohawk Valley. But there was also an article. I had never heard of this guy before, but I looked him up, and he's obviously well established. He was an advisor to Nelson Rockefeller. Grady Means put out an op-ed in The Hill a couple of weeks ago about the tough choices that municipalities will be facing amidst this crisis. Of course, he doesn't believe that the crisis, the COVID crisis, single-handedly brought us here. He would rather make the case that it's the pin that pricks the bubble. But let's for all of us and our listeners, let's take off our Republican and Democrat hats. And for those of you who are independents, let's just take off all hats and let's talk about a very difficult conversation that at some point is going to have to be addressed. And now, Dad, you've for decades have been studying and advising municipalities, school boards, strategic plans for them, projects on consolidation. With all of that experience in your pocket, in your tool bag, how do you address this this conversation in terms of a solution to move forward amidst this crisis?
All right. For starters, you know, it's the cities, the local governments, the states that are the great laboratories for change, not only in terms of economic development, but community development as well. Federal government is the funder, and the federal government provides money for local and state initiatives. It also exists to ensure that, you know, constitutional rights of people in local communities are treated equitably. But federal government should not dictate change. It should enable change. You know, secondly, I mean, that was the essence of the New Deal and the Great Society. It was, and for that matter, for President Reagan and Newt Gingrich, creating, helping to foster initiatives where they already existed, faith-based institutions. You know, why should the federal government feed and shelter the homeless when Catholic Charities and other faith-based charities are doing it? So that's the premise. The change should come from, you know, as close to the people as possible. And secondly, we are all facing the same thing. And it's hard to say it, but it needs to be said. Millions, probably tens of millions of people who are put out of work today are not going to go back to the jobs that they once had. We sort of foresaw that into the future. We know it. The coronavirus, the pandemic has accelerated that process. Businesses and local governments have got to make the transition to the next economy a whole lot sooner and a whole lot more, or I should say less painful than the change is going to be. And that's why it's very exciting that I have, and you are now working with these local governments and local community organizations to help them steer their future into the next economy, and not to try to recreate what already existed.
I mean, I would ask that, aren't we here today ultimately because of the New Deal and the Great Society? I mean, trillions and trillions in debt, and then the local governments and the state governments becoming maybe too dependent on the federal government. And I guess what I'm getting at is, I mean, it's abundantly clear that the federal government is, they have to bail out in entire sectors. They have to bail out state governments now. They have to bail out small businesses. They have to bail out households. I mean, it's just too much. They can't do that. I would imagine that they have to draw the line somewhere, and maybe that line is local governments and state governments. So if that's true, what is a municipality to do? And if we're talking about consolidation, how does consolidation actually work? How does it become fruitful for the community when some of that community fear that it means loss of jobs?
All right. So there are two overall points there. Okay. The first one is, it was the federal government that responded to enormous pain during the New Deal, and then after the riots in the 60s, the Great Society. Somebody had to do something, and there weren't sufficient resources on a local level or among faith-based institutions. They had dried up. They're incapable. There's only one funding generator that could meet that enormous need. And that's where we're at today. The second part is that we're dealing with local institutions that in many ways need to change to meet the times. I mean, when everything was human scale, when we were talking horse and buggies, those lines that separated little villages and towns made an awful lot of sense. But obviously, because of communications and other computer technologies, they just don't make any sense at all. And so what you have are layers of governments that are in many ways counterproductive. How do you plan for just one little village alone without, understanding that there are people just two blocks away who are in another village and who maybe might have more knowledge and more resources, but they live in a different village? So we're talking about a waste of money, a lack of talent. You consolidate governments. What you do is you consolidate your base of talent as well. And then you facilitate planning that way. The smaller communities just can't sustain a lot of the things that need to be done when they should be done in a world where people live. There are people who live in an Amsterdam, New York, where one spouse travels to Albany and the other spouse travels to Little Falls to work. That's the reality. Why do each spouse have to traverse through five or six school districts or seven or eight police departments in either direction, when the reality is those things should all be coordinated and better restructured?
So consolidation is no doubt the answer for local governments. I would contend, why is it then not the case for state and federal? And I don't necessarily mean geographically, but some sort of cuts, consolidation, something to free up the vast capital that one could argue is too concentrated in the hands of too many bureaucracies.
I totally agree with that that concept and that kind of policy. And the battle actually is not so much, within federal or state government levels, but it's among the public and the culture. I've dealt with school consolidations, for example, where citizens will say, "Oh, I know we can't afford it, but we also can't. What'll happen to the maroon and gold? My father and mother and grandparents and great grandparents fought for the maroon and gold. We have to keep our school district, even if we can't sustain it financially." Hey, it's the same thing with states. The great state of Mississippi will never bow to, and I'm just picking that out of a hat, will never yeah. bow to the dictates of the bullying state of New York. It's a cultural sort of thing. And I think that's kind of dissipating, that sentiment, where we're locked in, by state and local kinds of obstacles.
So, to get concrete here, and we talk about the need for cuts, at the federal level, and again, we're not wearing our Republican and Democrat hats. We're just asking questions as to what is necessary, what is feasible. If I were to start out with the intelligence community, do we need 17 intelligence agencies? That's just the first question that I have. I guess we could extend that into other areas, but let's do that.
No, we don't. Not that there isn't great work that's being done, but we saw after 9/11 that, one intelligence agency had all the information they needed about these 15 terrorists, but a lot of them were in files in boxes that were never shared with another major intelligence agency. There was a real lack of coordination. Now, President Bush created Homeland Security and put all of those, or almost all of those agencies, under one umbrella. But there's a huge disconnect that still exists. And sometimes those disconnects have nothing to do with the law. They have everything to do with personalities or, you know, one-upmanship. Well, I'm not going to share with them and let them take the credit when we deserve the credit. Ultimately, it does come down to things like that.
So what then becomes the future political discussion? I've long maintained that our current spectrum, our current debate of Democrat versus Republican, in my eyes, has just become so watered down. Mm-hmm. It doesn't really have any substance, but, you know, through my eyes. I because I'm such a lover of history, and I go back so far in history, not just excluding myself to the study of American history. I do believe that there is some real objectivity in the debate between the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists, because at the end of the day, that's an even older debate that goes back to Thomas Hobbes and John Locke, mm-hmm. which then even just goes back to an older debate of, I guess you could say, control versus versus freedom, right? I mean, there have been societies where, you know, say Rome was a republic, and then Rome became an empire. So the republic was more in the eyes of Locke. It's funny to take something older and, you know, apply something newer and label it, but and then the empire was more Hobbesian. So I mean, is that a return to the political debate that we have in the future, or is there something else that you see?
No, I think that will always be with us. The power of the state is enhanced by technologies, and that is the growing debate. I mean, certainly one way to fight a pandemic or to reduce the chances of another pandemic is to have all of us with trackers and have the capacity to collect data on our movements, our interactions, our private conversations. On the other hand, the essence of being, I'm going to say a human, let alone just simply an American, is that we want to have our own privacy. And that's legitimate. But by the same token, as we've learned over the years, if the technology exists, how do you keep that technology genie in the bottle? So that will continue to be a debate. And I think, like everything else, that debate is being accelerated in its pace because we also do have to battle a pandemic and prevent another one. So I think this is the age-old debate, what that goes even back to the Greeks, doesn't it?
Well, I had a lot of questions, and I'm satisfied. So I love the way that our conversation flowed, and I look forward to our next one that will be, all as always, real and unscripted.
Same here, and I love it. I love talking to you, and I love you. And I'm encouraging people to share these podcasts with others if you so desire, and to write to us and let us know what you think. Have a good week.
I love you too, Dad.
Take care.
Have a great week.